Yeah, time to get our view from the middle. He was in Sac Lake City last week, Washington Beach, Utah. First college football playoff committee rankings are out. We also have a Game 7 in the World Series. This is not a typical midweek. Find his work for USA Today online, usatoday.com on Twitter. The handle is at George Schroeder. A happy Wednesday to you, George. Welcome to November. How's it going?
It's good, man. Hard to believe it's November, but kind of fun.
It sure is. You wrote a piece called The Post Week 9 that posted on Monday, and I used the term symmetric on Monday with West Virginia and Baylor losing. You know, you had one unbeaten from the other four conferences. So I guess pick your order. For sure it was going to be Bama, Clemson, Michigan, and Washington. And then it wasn't. So what was your read or level of surprise for the first selection committee rankings?
Oh, I was pretty surprised. And I think they got it wrong, but they didn't ask me. And
come on.
That's okay. They also did not ask you. Look, I've seen Washington play twice now in person. I saw them play in Eugene. Obviously, Duck fans saw that one rather not. But they're really good. I saw them play against a good Utah team and overcome a challenge, significant challenge on the road last weekend, and I came away even more impressed, quite frankly, because those are the kind of games that you can lose. I got to tell you, I don't think the committee is given a lot of due respect. I'll say this. It's clear that the committee wanted to talk about strength of schedule and things like that, and to this point in the season, you can certainly make a case. You know, Washington's non-conference schedule was not good. Texas A&M beat UCLA and has played a tougher schedule to this point. That said, I think two things. One, if you're going to rank a one-loss team ahead of Washington, I think Ohio State's resume is better at this point, despite the fact that they're not playing great football probably on the eye test. I think their resume is better at this point. They've beaten a Wisconsin team you have in your top 10 playoff selection committee, and they blew the doors off an Oklahoma team you have ranked number 14. A&M beat an Auburn team you also have ranked in your top 10, but at the time they beat them, I don't think anybody would argue that that's the same Auburn team we see now. And they were non-competitive, to be honest, in a 19-point loss at Alabama. And so, you know, all that said, we can argue all we want. This is how they put it. This is how they ranked it. It will switch. Might not be next week. It might not be the week after that, although I suspect sometime in the next 3 or 4 weeks it will switch. If Washington continues to win, it won't matter what Texas A&M does.
Yeah, I agree with that. But, I guess in the long run, it really doesn't matter where you're ranked totally when the playoffs actually start. But if you had to go 1, 2, 3, 4 and it mattered, like say home field advantage was in the mix, I mean, what would be your top four in order?
I'd have them exactly the way they had them, except that I would have Washington in the four at the four seed at this point. At this point, I think Alabama has been every bit as impressive as everybody else thinks. I mean, they've looked really, really good. I don't think they're perfect. I don't think that they can't be beaten. I'm not one of those guys. And I think Clemson hasn't yet put it all together, but they probably got the most impressive resume on paper of what in terms of who they've beaten of anybody at this point. And so, I mean, they won at Auburn, and again, not the same Auburn team as we see now.
Sure.
But Auburn's defense has been there all year, and they beat Louisville. They just won at Florida State, which currently is ranked. I don't know if they will be later. We'll see. And so I would go 1, Alabama, 2, Clemson. I would go 3, Michigan. I think it's pretty clear Jim Harbaugh's got it going. And I would have Washington number 4. That said, there's a lot of football left to be played. Some of this stuff's going to play in or out. Ohio State's got its chance to make its case, you know, if they beat Michigan. And Washington just needs to keep winning. We'll see what happens. But that's how I would do it right now. And I think Washington is a complete team. I don't know that I think at this point that they're – overall talent level stacks up to the first three teams I mentioned, but that doesn't mean you can't win a bunch of games. And I have a lot of respect for and confidence in Chris Peterson for having teams that play even over their heads in terms of their talent level.
Now, as I mentioned, things got a little on the symmetric side because now there's no unbeaten teams in the Big 12. Is there any logic to the much ado about nothing and when push comes to shove? While unlikely, the four unbeatens just run through, you know, the Tide, the Wolverines, the Clemson, and Huskies win out, that you'd bet your bottom dollar it's going to be that four? Or now do we need to wonder what's up the selection committee's sleeve?
No. Look, if those four unbeatens run the table, they'll be in it. In fact, I'll go so far as to say any of the four that runs the table is in it. I don't care which one. I don't care what else happens. Any of the four is in it. I also think that Washington could afford a loss as long as it still wins the Pac-12 and would get in over a non-champion one-loss team right now, unless that non-champion one-loss team was somehow Alabama, which could happen.
Right.
but I think, you know, I'm, you know, sticking with the week's controversy, which may go away by next week or the week after, I think a 12-1 Washington Pac-12 champion would end up passing an 11-1 Texas A&M, for example, which did not win the SEC or its own division. But I don't bet, but I would definitely suspect that if you go unbeaten, you're in. Look, that, by the way, we're not going to have four unbeaten.
I know.
I'll just go out on a limb and say that's not going to happen.
You know it's not going to happen. But you always, you got to bring it up because that's how it stands. Well, in case the opportunity comes up, I'll bet for you. I want to hit on that Clemson game against Florida.
You probably can bet that, I'm sure.
I looked on my site. It's not available just yet.
Okay.
All right. Florida State-Clemson game. Man, the Seminoles have been involved in some nail biters. North Carolina, Miami, this. Jimbo Fisher drew a fine for ripping into the refs. You wrote about it. Dalvin Cook in the fourth quarter had a long run called back. Jimbo kind of lost it. Then they got an unsportsmanlike flag. For those who didn't see it, you covered it. You posted the video. You know, what was the call? And does it turn out that Fisher was actually wrong?
Well, I think he thought they called a chop block, which it was not. But they didn't call it a chop block. They called it an illegal block below the waist, which, outside the tackle box, you can't deliver a block below the waist from behind, basically.
Right.
You have to make the initial contact from the front. And it was, if you look at the play, it was clearly delivered from the back. Now, I'm not completely convinced he made a ton of contact, but I think by the letter of the rule, they got it right. And that, all that said, you know, it was one of several calls that went awry in that game. It wasn't a stellar officiating night for the officials, but you know, a few minutes later, they completely missed. And I still don't know how you missed this. They completely missed an obvious face mask that led to a sack of Deshaun Watson. So I mean, and I believe that they had to ended up helping the drive stall, and they had to get rid of it. I'd have to go back and look at it. But I mean, the point is they missed calls both ways. And after having seen the play a couple times, I'm not sure it was a missed call, period, but it certainly wasn't an egregious missed call. And then that's before we ever get to the fact that Fisher went nuts on the sideline.
He sure did.
Somebody, they say it wasn't him, but somebody drew an unsportsmanlike conduct penalty for the things they were saying and doing on the sideline. And then, you know, obviously kept going in the post game and just basically a pretty epic coach rant, which is, you know, make him $20,000 lighter in the wallet. You know, it's kind of like you and me having to pay $2 or $3.
Yeah, I know. We're talking with George Schroeder, USA Today. You know, in the post game, I understand there's a decorum, and you players and coaches, for the most part, they sit there and they need to fulfill their obligation. But for some reason, at the professional and the collegiate level, officials are off limits. Is there any logic to when there's a game like that, a big game, a lot on the line, and there's obviously a level of controversy with the refs, would you be in favor of having the head ref or somebody just be available to just answer some questions?
Oh, yeah. I'm always for that. But, you know, some people out there are going, yeah, because you're a reporter. Well, yeah, that's part of it. But I do think that there's a layer of non or unaccountability that's sort of built in there. And they have setups where you can have pool reporters for things, but the window of which topics you can ask about is so narrow that it typically doesn't impact a lot of things. Now, I don't think they should have to answer questions about every call all the time, but I do think sort of widening that window and broadening the topics about which they could be asked something, even if it's just a designated pool reporter, which is what they have now, would be a good thing. I don't expect that's going to happen anytime soon, because I think there's a pervasive attitude, and I think this is largely correct, that you undermine the credibility of officials if you ask about it, if they're able to be asked about a ton of different calls, and then they may be right about the call, but it's sort of hard to explain to the layman, especially on, kind of in that kind of a setting. So I don't think anybody's going to change that idea, but I'd be all in favor of more openness in terms of those guys answering questions. The coaches and the players are largely accountable after games for mistakes they've made.
Yeah, I think also, I don't see it. Most people don't see it. The officials are accountable within their respective conferences as far
as
getting grading and stuff like
that. That's right. And they really are most of the time, too. It's just that you're right. We don't typically see that. And, if they're not very good at what they do, it may impact their assignments and even their employment as far as that goes.
All right. After LSU lost at Auburn 18-13, they fired Les Miles. Much was made of his unwillingness to make some changes offensively. And then it seems like the guy who always comes to the rescue, be it USC or LSU, Mr. Interim Coach Ed Orgeron took over, and they've won them all since. Danny Etling playing well at quarterback. Leonard Fournette came back and ran for 285. So early in the year, you look November 5th, Alabama, LSU, then we kind of forgot about it. Now all of a sudden, this one got interesting again, no?
Yeah, no, it is interesting again. I mean, Alabama's favored by, a touchdown or something like that in Baton Rouge. A little bit more than that, and I guess probably about right. But this is definitely an interesting game again when, a month ago after Les Miles was fired, you wouldn't have thought it was going to be interesting.
Right.
And instead, you're right, Ed Orgeron has stabilized the program. And this suddenly becomes a really big game, I think, for him. If they somehow pull off the upset against Alabama, it's going to be really hard not to give him the head coaching job. Now, on a permanent basis, I don't think that's necessarily the right move long-term for them, but I think that's probably what would happen. And so it'll be really interesting. They're definitely playing much better. And look, their defense has been pretty decent. They're very talented on defense. The problem, obviously, was their offense, as it had been so many years under Les Miles. And under Orgeron, they have opened things up. And, they're playing a little more fast and free than they played in the past and not quite as, stuck in the mud, archaic, sort of conventional. We just want to slam the ball in here and then occasionally try to throw the ball. They're not doing that as much. They're playing a lot more free, and it's really worked.
Yeah.
Now they're about to take a dramatic step up in competition level. Let's not forget that. And they still got Texas A&M left on the schedule too.
We're talking with George Schroeder, USA Today. One final thought, as we pivot from college football. Game 7 in the World Series, we're either going to see a 68 or 108-year drought end. The series has pulled historic ratings, best in about 20 years. Do you have a particular rooting interest here, or do you see this as just, hey, this is a major sporting event that's really intriguing?
I'm glad you mentioned the 68-year drought, because it feels like in the main coverage of this, we've only heard about 1908 and the GOAT and the Cubs. And I almost feel bad for the Indians, because in any other year, against any other National League team, they would be the cute feel-good story.
Yep.
And instead, we don't even hear they're part of the deal. We only hear about the Cubs. There's a little bit of backlash in my own mind about that whole deal, because I think the Indians are a cool story too. But one way or the other, we're going to have a giant drought ended. And do I have a rooting interest? No, I really don't. I think it'll be tremendous fun. And, it feels like the Cubs suddenly have momentum, but baseball, things seem to change. So we'll see.
All right.
I'll say one thing.
Yeah.
This game should be in Wrigley Field.
Yeah, if the sports gods really had their act together, it probably would be. But
if the baseball commissioner had his act together and hadn't decided he was going to try to make a meaningless All-Star game meaningful, by doing home field advantage off of it. I mean, look, regardless of who you want to win, the team with the better record should be the team that gets to host the. I mean, the Cubs were the best, had the best record in baseball.
Oh yeah,
and there's, you know, they were clearly the best team over the course of the regular season. They should have the right to have the home field advantage here. It shouldn't be because, you know, a bunch of guys who were just sort of having fun slapping the ball around the yard in an All-Star game won.
No, the bottom line is, if the 2002 All-Star game wasn't in Bud Selig's city of Milwaukee with the rain and the delay and the tie, we're probably not having this conversation. It's that crazy.
Right. And we shouldn't be having it. So, right. I mean, regardless of who you're for or who you want to win or whatever, it's too bad this game isn't where it should be tonight.
All right. Hey, good stuff as always, George. I know you get to stay home this weekend, which is cool. Catch us work. USAtoday.com on Twitter, at George Schroeder. Always our pleasure, George. Enjoy the weekend.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
All right. Take it easy.